Thank you. As Professor Lopez Garza indicated, I am Victor Carrillo. I get the pleasure and the honor of introducing to you Sesha Foster, mainly because I am Professor Lopez Garza's husband. But in addition, because I count Sesha among my friends, specifically among a circle of friends and a group of writers, both centered in LA and throughout California and the rest of the nation, who take writing as a mission, as a passion. I think if you have already read some of his works, in Atomic Aztecs, or if you pick up the book after this event, you will discover that Sesha is a complex writer. You wouldn't know it from interacting with him as a friend. He seems humble enough, he seems simple enough, but always in that mind of his, something is clicking. And Sesha is political, he is kind and generous, and he is creative. And what he shares with you today is from Atomic Aztecs, I believe. But he has other work. Primarily, I think of Sesha as a poet. And poetry, I think, is what defines Atomic Aztecs. And it is what defines City Terrace, Field Manual, which is a prior publication about City Terrace in LA. Prose, poetry, both, neither, something in between. Poetry at the heart, poetry at the core. And previous to that, Angry Days, which is his first publication of poetry, which reveals at sort of an earlier period of writing that reflects Sesha Foster, the traveler. Sesha likes to travel. He likes to venture out, whether it's with friends or with family. And I think what you will find in his work is that adventure. And I think what you will discover as a reader is that that adventure can be chaotic, but can be a process of discovery about ourselves and about our reality. And so with that, please welcome very strongly and very happily Sesha Foster.
Please come on in and get a seat if you can find one. There's a couple seats up here in front and down on the side. There's refreshments pick up on the way. Thank you very much, Victor, for the introduction, and Martha, George, Catherine, for having me out here today, all of you for coming out on a beautiful afternoon. Let's see, maybe we can get the slides. The slides that I'm going to be running are by a colleague of mine. Arturo Romo is an artist, and together we're producing a website called The East LA Guide, www.elaguide.org, and sort of volunteering our time for that project if we can get it up and running. The East LA Guide is meant to commemorate important cultural sites and historical events in East LA. That project and some of my other books come about in response to sort of the way East LA is regarded and treated culturally in general. For example, if you pick up the Lonely Planet Guide to Los Angeles, and there's a map of Los Angeles in there, and you check out the map, It shows you how to get to the west side, where Hollywood is oriented, and so on and so forth. And where East LA would be on the map, they put the key on top of East LA. I guess in order to, so you don't even have to look at it. And all of the cultural politics of representation is changing all the time. That's the kind of representational void that I grew up sort of being used to, taking for granted. So that while I was thinking to myself as an artist, as a writer, I felt like it was going to be incumbent on me to represent East LA in some way. Because the people that I grew up with and the place that I come from relates to that, and then I thought that that would be a useful and important project as a writer to undertake, because by and large it's denied. It's not romantic. It's not especially trendy. It's not a kind of vacation spot for many. There's no Club Med next to the Farmer John packing plant. So that's kind of reason behind a number of the books and works that I engage in, and other people in this room are engaged in similar projects, no doubt. The slides that are being shown are in and around the Farmer John packing plant in the city of Vernon. City of Vernon being that industrial area that was incorporated precisely in order to get around any kind of regulation of industry. The Farmer John packing plant, which is this is just a parking lot. Let's see when one comes up. There it is. This is a smokehouse. There's a wall on the smokehouse. The Farmer John packing plant processes 6,000 pigs per day. It's the largest packing plant west of the Mississippi River. The pigs come in at all hours, mostly during the nighttime, and sort of in order to get some of these pictures and in order to get some of the information in the book, Arturo and I sort of lurked around the corners and pretended that we were deeply interested in pigs, that we were pig fanciers, fans of pigs. There's the front gate of the plant on Soto Street. The security always ran us off. There's a couple workers going into the entrance. Security always ran us off. The security is very heavy. I worked for about 2 or 3 years simply to get inside the plant, on and off. They're very sensitive, I guess, about the plant, about what goes on inside the plant. They're very sensitive about it because of that there's pain and death going on inside the plant. It's sort of only animals. It's breakfast sausage. It's chorizo. But they're very sensitive about who is allowed in, what you can see, and their whole orientation when you go inside the plant is to make sure that you know everything is antiseptic and clean. And there's a hairnet that the workers wear on the line. And And then, of course, the whole building is surrounded by this mural that attempts to show the pigs as frolicking and happy and having a great time. So at any rate, I chose the Farmer John packing plant not because I have any kind of particular political axe to grind with the meat industry. I mean, I know that the whole agricultural industries, including the meat industry, are part of an important kind of politics that every time we pick up lunch, every time we eat something, you know, that food connects us to the farm workers and the conditions that they live in the fields, the conditions of the animals that are grown and sacrificed for that industry, and so on and so forth. In this immense chain, not only of biology, but of economics and culture and history and all of that. But but this book is not Fast Food Nation. It's more actually I picked the plant because it's just more metaphorical about those things that are hidden from us on a daily basis, about the fact that our food that is hidden from us really, where our daily sustenance comes from, and really the meaning itself of major parts of our life. Let me go on to read a part of this book that describes the plant a bit. Okay, just out front, on the inside gate, there's a taco truck. I watch Kusatli, Weasel, giving me the eye sometimes around the taco truck, especially since he only has one left, which he usually likes to keep fixed on the voluptuous chavalita in the skin-tight shirt, particularly while she's leaning her chest across the counter to hand someone their order through the little window over his head, maybe at nighttime, with the vapors rising in the night from smokestacks lit from below here and there by spotlights, steam rising from the styrofoam cups the men stand around holding on break, steam rising from their mouths like feathered plumes of speech in codices. Generally, I choose not to believe in paranoia per se. I don't go for Ray's conspiracy theory of the universe that says everything is the result of three jokers meeting in a hotel room in Miami in 1961 and the rest is just domino theories. Gerald Ford's presidential pardon after the fact, smoke and mirrors. But there's something in Kusatli's glance that gives me pause. Fuck you, Weasel. What do I got that you want? I'll be thinking while smiling at La Sonia, who's handing me the paper plate de carnitas, which I'm careful to keep level lest it drip grease down my front, make me look like another used up motherfucker in front of La Chula teen girl, who's handing me the fistful of change with an unnerving, dark-eyed smile that seems to recall something more important to be remembering than any of the rest of this. But I step over to the picnic tables provided for the 3 a.m. repast with a glance at Weasel. In fact, he's nonchalantly watching me as he leans against the truck, like he's taking his sweet time to order. As I sit down, I nod to him as if I appreciate his support in our bid to certify the Pinchy Union. Sure. Here's to you, Kusatli. And I tear off a bite of savory, crisp pork flesh. Tortilla soft as the skin of a woman's belly in moonlight, with the aromatic, picante roasted chile salsa filling my sinuses. At 3 a.m., you find nothing beats a belly full of heart attack carnitas topped with smoky salsa. Swallowing hot coffee, you have to head back into the plant and go another 8-hour shift. What do I know about Pusatli? He's an okay worker, works hard and fast but sloppy. They're always shuffling him around in jobs that can't be screwed up too bad or pairing him off with someone more reliable. Maybe somebody's looking out for him. Certainly if I had his rep, I'd be looking over my shoulder. In the glare of the roach coach fluorescence against the absorbent dark, Pusatli lifts his face to jive La Sonia, and any passersby peering through the plant gate not too far away wouldn't see any distinguishing marks, even at this distance. Nothing to set Weasel apart from the rest of us. No matter the grinning witticisms, the raffish charm that three turkey, knockout, and even pirate, you could say, have him on his side, and his black hair parted in a boyish, spiky cut. Only the dark scar rising from an empty eye socket, indicating a bit of trouble in his past. That indication, too, almost exactly like any of the rest of us. You can't go this distance and come this far without scars of some kind. So what if you knew, heard he kept women with families on both sides of the border, lost kids from one when he gambled his way into debt with gangsters on the lookout to kill him to this very day? So he told his friends and relations that he was going to commit suicide, ran away, never to be seen by anyone again. And then he's back here in a blue Farmer John jumpsuit, looking just like any of the rest of us. I mean, obviously, the entire workforce of the Farmer John packing plant, like most of the people that basically run this city, is are immigrants. They have the safety signs in three different languages, one or two versions of Chinese and Vietnamese and Spanish and English. Then there's the LA River, where the effluent comes out of the back of the plant and weird brown soap suds float down the LA River on the back of the big pipes that come out of the plant. All right. So here's a bit of a riff on that's actually the outside of the kill house. Here's a bit of a riff on immigrants coming to work and ending up in the meatpacking industry. For a couple of years, I lived out in Iowa City, and throughout the Midwest. Now, there are towns that used to be emptying out, where the old-time, all-white population was leaving and going to the cities, and now there's all the downtowns are full of Mexicans out there, and they're working in the meatpacking plants across the United States, and food is better. All right. So it wasn't easy for me to get a good job like this in the meat industry. I wasn't born working in the slaughterhouse. I crossed deserts to get here. I traversed the mountains of the Rumorosa and the Coast Range, skirting secret borders of history and identity. I sacrificed the past, relationships and dreams of community, tore open blisters and stubbed my toe on rocks. Empires lay in ruins along the way. I survived long odds, bad luck, and bad trips as one of a select few. I negotiated with coyotes, rubbed elbows with travelers from everywhere, hung out under the watchful eye of the migra. Lots of people, maybe most, don't make it this far. When the maroon Buick Riviera rolled over four times in the desert outside of Riverside, who do you think climbed out of the trunk and puked on a rock? When 19 other Batos were asphyxiated in the boxcar in the Arizona sun, Who do you think was last alive, sucking air out of a tiny rust hole? Who do you think tried hardest to live and go on? Who do you think kept walking across the desert with water and plastic jugs tied to both ends of a stick when the rest of them gave up, wandered off to die black under a bush? Those ain't my bones, unknown out there, not my teeth, scattered like broken necklaces. Mice aren't making a nest in my jacket elbow. Sow bugs sleeping under what's left of my shoes. Blackbirds aren't playing with a tuft of my hair. Rattlesnakes aren't sleeping in my last resting place. The cottontail is not hightailing it from a piece of paper with my name on it, blowing across the gravel wash, and the creosote bush doesn't wear one of my socks. The wind isn't whispering my last words. I stayed alert at all times to every possibility in the given moment. I had to keep my mind alive to multiple chances hidden inside of every second. I had to feel the potentiality of a living moment where every next step could lead to death or to life. There are secret worlds hidden in the air. Secret possibilities that can keep you alive in the worst of situations. You got to find them or you may not make it. When the odds are all against you, you got to consider there might be one possible thing left for you to do, or one misstep to avoid. Your life depends on it. That's why I think like this. It's gotten me this far. I've been waylaid, ripped off, and turned around, and still made my way. I offer you suggestions on how to survive. You go through all this, you too can get yourself in a job in the industrial sector, like the city of Vernon, slicing heads off pigs. With a circular saw descending from the ceiling, its yellow electrical cord recoiling overhead, hogs' heads rolling across the floor with a helpful kick every now and then, as you can reconsider behind the plastic safety goggles the fact your wife may have left you in spirit a long time before she leaves you in the flesh. And you can see that now as the saw bites through the back, through the neck of the next hog, bits of skin shredding as you press the ripping business end all the way through to the spine. I concede I still owe my ex-mother-in-law $2,000 for a front-end repair that didn't take. My kids, who don't talk anymore, now gangbangers or evangelical Christians. Now they got it made in America, they disdain my values, everything I sacrifice and work for. This thought alone might kill me if I let it. And sometimes I did want to die. You better watch yourself, I told myself. Sometimes you get a glimpse passing blurry in the little windows inset into the steel doors, muttering to myself. Sometimes your worst enemy is yourself. I heard that the suicide rate is 100% higher than the murder rate, and that guy in the mirror, he's giving me nasty looks. I was disappointed that Arturo Romo didn't include, there's the smokehouse, I guess you can't see that one. That Arturo Romo didn't catch, he didn't put a picture on here of the security guard who rides a tricycle around the plant. It's not a small tricycle, it's a big tricycle, but it's the only time I've ever seen that. All right. I guess the Aztecs in this book are not real Aztecs. They're like fake Aztecs. I mean, basically the book is divided between the metaphorical slaughterhouse and a symbolic symbolic Aztec world, which is basically just used to make fun of this one, a satire of current politics and policies in our brave new world order. The Aztecs had a kind of religious interpretation of time, so that every, well, there's Arturo Rumo. And the one picture that I did take. The Aztecs had a religious interpretation of time, which they commemorated through blood sacrifice. That's probably a standard knowledge. And they had they used the top of their pyramids for these sacrifices, and one of their anniversary commemorations involved hand-to-hand combat on top of pyramids with captive warriors. This is my interpretation of that one. Tied to the Tizoc stone, I did a little dance back and forth, swift, evasive maneuvering, busting out my secret moves, drawing on every aspect of secret Shaolin martial arts training, sweat stinging my eyes as I gripped the machete as a protective shield, and Comrade Mashla, keeper of the House of Mist, stepped up and casually let fly arrow after arrow. I almost deflected that first arrow, its razor-sharp steel quadriflange hunting head pinging off the machete blade as it slid straight up the length of my left forearm, ripping furrowed skin the whole way, burrowing the length of my forearm to bury its point deep inside my elbow. Yowee! Wee silly fucking poachly! I was wondering how she was going to do that one. I wanted to see. I never felt anything like that before. Did that hurt or what? I almost deflected that one. Actually, the sensation of that first arrow ripping through my forearm, bearing its point inside my elbow, reminded me of the time when I was 8 years old watching my mom cry, asking her, why was her nose bleeding? Dad hit her in the face, stupid, my sister said. And I turned to make sure we were together as we departed that life forever. Then the next arrow struck me. I had just finished a Michael Jackson-type Shirley Temple dance move, which I figured would fake Machla out entirely. So he would either have to miss me completely or strike some vital organ, put me out of my misery first thing. But he must have anticipated it. High on the inside, since the arrow embedded itself through both buttocks and the right side of my ass, even as I prepared, the smirk of victory. That smirk shapeshifted instantly into an astonished yowl of banshee excruciation. Fuck a duck! Fuck the famous golden Peking duck your mama rode into town on. I howled. Oxygenated sun flares from outer space blasted my spinal column. I was all of a sudden in a supernova of her. Yukio Mishima and his homo fantasies of Saint fucking Sebastian, I gasped. Possibly pissed myself a little there. The second arrow reminded me of that time when I thought I was cool at the new school, the new kid, looking for a brand new start. So I flirted with this cute girl in art class, and she flirted with me. I waited for her after school, but she ditched me. I saw her leaving on the back of some guy's motorcycle. That second arrow hurt my feelings a lot. I gritted my teeth and threw the machete at Maxla, keeper of the House of Mist. I could no longer see him very well. He was just a shadow on the inside of the blood-red last light of the afternoon. Seems he stepped to the side without any exertion, the machete clanked, spinning away into space over the crowd, which was having the experience of a lifetime. Ask anyone who was there that day. They will tell you it was the best thing they'd ever seen. That crowd was roaring. Whoever got hit by the machete when it landed below added his or her own personal sacrifice to the whole ritual. They loved it. They'd have the scar of the lifetime, proving they too were there. The third arrow struck my right thigh, dead center above the knee, so I went down. I was screaming, you can bet your ass, or what weechly fucking postly ever. Falling on the arrow, driving it further into the other side of my leg. One side of my mind was annotating the principles of thermodynamics from 1905 while I was simultaneously whistling motherfucking Dixie like I was fit to be fried in the electric chair. I was beside myself, convulsing with extra screams, busily commenced to do a one-handed push-up. Arrows sticking out of my body. I used to be good at that sort of thing, but I couldn't seem to catch my breath. That last arrow reminded me of the time when I walked the streets day after day, 1930, week after week, looking for work. I was 15 years old, half starved. And all they told me was they'd call me. None of them ever did. The rest of the year, I couldn't get a full-time job washing dishes, scraping bottoms of peanut butter jars for my dinner. Somebody or something was kicking my ass that whole year down the back alleys of the entire city. I struggled to sitting position with my back against the Tizoc stone when the fourth arrow went through my right shoulder. After that, I lost count. I lost patience. What the hell? I couldn't keep up. Not if Mashla was going to keep shooting arrows that fast. You know, when you fill out insurance forms and police reports on these types of events, they are always asking you to recall every detail. But I'm sorry. At that point, I could no longer keep count. The fourth arrow did happen to remind me of... the fuck if I know. I don't know. What? Standing in the unemployment line? No, maybe like the look on the woman's face in the cubicle in back of the employment office, looking at her contact information, writing out numbers on the piece of scratch paper for you, handing it to you to get you out of her office with that look. The fourth arrow reminded me of the sound a baby's head makes when it falls out the high chair and onto the kitchen floor. Because mom's busy doing housework, distracted by something else. That fourth arrow reminded me of ice crystals in the wind hitting your face as you stand at an old mass grave, long since cemented over on the sunny winter day. It's taken you a long time to arrive at this gravesite. The fourth arrow reminded me of the anonymity of death into which they drive whole peoples. The fourth arrow hurt. It reminded me of the dark kitchen, the squalor of love. It reminded me not to be afraid. Death is like this. The fourth quadriflange arrow angled through my shoulder, stopped at the Tizoc stone at my back. As I fell forward, this arrow reminded me that my pain is so deep that I ache now without explanation. The pain never had a cause, nor does it lack a cause now. If they slashed my throat all the way through, my pain would still be the same, no matter what happens. I almost dodged all those arrows. That bastard just got in a lucky shot, if it wasn't for that. Except that never happened. Let me make that clear. I would never let that happen. That might have happened on some alternate reality when I wasn't looking, on some other world when they didn't let me get in my 2 cents. But it didn't happen this time because I wouldn't let it happen. I had to make my move sooner at some previous point in history, so that could never occur. Maybe I should take some questions. break it up a little bit. How are we doing on time? Completed. It was by and large completed around 2004, and published just like a couple weeks shy of 2006. Yes, Eric.
Essentially, when you're writing them, how do these thoughts and these long, expressive moments emerge in your creative consciousness?
I do a continuous, you know, amount of study and reading, and was always interested in the conquest of the Americas, and obviously I think that all of us are engaged in becoming settlers of wherever we're at. We live in a civilization that is the kind of tourist civilization that is interested in taking the resources and moving on, but we ourselves are faced with the dilemma of trying to settle where we're at and actually live here in some place. And so the long sentences, I think, evolved from thinking over years and decades about what being in this place means. What does it mean to be in a place where the majority of people have no voice, where the majority of people are kind of denied the fact that they're here? You know, it is still the case that if you pick up the Fat Library of America Literature of Los Angeles, that is largely white male, and that there's a couple of black authors in there, but virtually nothing about the East Side. And so, you know, the Aztec iconography that shows up in the book and is examined from, you know, this satirical point of view comes about because that was the iconography that I grew up with during the Chicano movements when the murals with that iconography were all over our neighborhoods. And so that's the kind of perspective, and those are the images, and that's the politics from which I view the world. And so I want to make sure that it's part of the writing itself. Yes.
Thank you for being here today. I have a question. I saw through the writing, is there any symbolic meaning for using K's instead of C's and Q's?
I guess the symbolic meaning was that I wanted to signal that it's some kind of mutated or altered perspective that is not meant to be taken either literally on one hand or scientifically on another, that it is somehow mutated and changed by being written the way that it is, and different. There's a little bit of the 60s thing where you know, they used to always replace the C in America with a K. It's all too corny, right? But its corniness is in there. The corniness is in there, too.
Yeah. Going off of that question, you use a lot of different languages and kind of mix codes and stuff in the text. Can you talk a little about that?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an attempt to weave in a bunch of registers and a bunch of different kinds of voices. A lot of the, you know, sort of related to the earlier question about how do the long lines and the writing come together. It comes together in part by the language of people that I hear in East LA, which is not represented, in the media. It's that language that is very specific to place and evokes that place, and one way of reimagining community is to rethink and reformulate the voices of the community and mix them together. I mean, it mixes in, language that's academic, that might come out of university publications. I threw in quotes from Marx and Lenin because they were sort of a big part of the politics of the 60s and 70s. I mean, I grew up during the Vietnam War, which the venal corruption of the U.S. government during the Vietnam War seems exactly like the venal corruption of the government of our own time, of this time now. The same kind of thing where the fake Gulf of Tonkin incident was used to allow the U.S. government to start invading and bombing a country that it never officially declared war on. And then last night there was the Bill Moyers thing about how the fake weapons of mass destruction and the fake ties to Al-Qaeda was used to start that. And so so part of it actually comes about from wanting to change. I mean, some of the language, and especially the identity politics language of the 1960s, is still used to categorize us all today, so that when we're discussing our identities in universities or in bookstores or among publishers or whatever, then it's all sort of broken down according to those racial categories they developed in the 60s and 70s to categorize all of us. And in response to the racist history of this country, it was an assertion of identity among people of color during the 60s and 70s that was in part responsible for making those categories so prevalent and important, because it meant that people of color actually had identity. But on the other hand, you know, we're still using those same categories 30, 40 years later. There's still possible nuances that those categories, or meanings that those categories overlook, that those categories. It used to be that on books, you know, they used to put at the top on the back, and probably you can go into the bookstore and check, but they used to put like Chicano literature or Asian American literature or whatever, and like on white people's books, it'd just be literature. And so there's all these issues, really, that's hidden in that language and in those racial categories, that the reimagining of that kind of language out of the 60s and 70s, for me, is an attempt to hold that to light, that kind of language of our identities that especially for you know, people who are mixed or mestizo or half-breed or whatever, that you're either one or the other, you're not both or all, or that there's some kind of borders and boundaries. I mean, when I, in the 60s, I had friends who, you know, were part of these leftist organizations who believed that that there was a black belt in the South that would be the black nation, and the Chicano nation would be the Southwest, and I don't know, that for us Asians, we would like have a passport to get out of Little Tokyo or something. but you know, like it was a little different or a little weird to be dealing with that when you were kind of spread across the borders.
Speaking of the 60s and 70s, I think I read, says you, that somewhere that your book was a result of a particularly long hallucinatory flashback. Is that true?
I think I would deny that officially. We could maybe talk about that later. I didn't think I had engaged in any hallucinatory flashbacks for a while. I have my coffee and my water. But I mean, part of it is a kind of an attempt to engage language on that kind of hallucinatory level. Let me go there with it. That a lot of standard literature that you pick up has been edited so that it's easy to read, so that it's easy to digest, so that the editors expect it will sell more. Indeed, it will work. It works too. That it does sell more. That if the writing is less dense, less long and hallucinatory, more bite-sized and simple, that indeed the books sell more. They have figured that out. On the other hand, I think that it doesn't really reflect the complexity and sort of hallucinatory, the hallucinations that reality itself always evokes for us in daily life, as part of daily life. That daily life is neither so neat and simple as most writing makes it, and that is sort of more complex. Yes?
I have a question about the title. Why did you choose the title, Atomic Aztecs?
Atomic Aztecs. Well, I guess, you know, like when we were growing up, that adjective atomic was applied to all kinds of things. The old Atomic Cafe in downtown LA, that's not there anymore. But it was applied to these things, and what it signified was a future, some kind of bright and glorious technological future where atomic energy and technology would cure all ills, especially like social ills. And so it's a, you know, it's just sort of play on that word that Bob Marley in one of his songs calls atomic misphilosophy. That belief that technology is going to solve the political sort of disasters that they're busily developing all around us and counting on college students to fix when you guys graduate. So I'm glad that you guys are doing it. Yes?
I'm just curious about the relationship between the descriptions of the beheading of the pigs and the sacrifices.
Yeah, like I guess like I say, there's a number of writers, Ruth Ozeki in her book, My Year of Meats, which takes place in the meatpacking industry. Obviously, there's the movie and the book, Fast Food Nation, and so on and so forth, that are kind of making that correlation between human, the human condition and the way that we treat food animals, and so on and so forth. And I guess for me it wasn't that kind of direct and overt. It was just something that I was interested in as a hidden part of our city that we live in, a hidden part of the neighborhoods that I was living in. I was curious about what goes on in the Farmer John meat packing plant as a, just as something hidden. I didn't really know, I didn't really have a correlation between animals and human sacrifice. I mean, I think it just is the case where things are kept hidden, usually there's something, you know, it allows for bad things to happen.
I just wonder, could you make, I love the statement about the secret borders of history and identity. I guess that's kind of where I wanted to see if we could talk a little bit more about that. And to me, I saw that being manifested as actual visual images, but what I'm more interested in is you're talking about those secret or hidden borders of, okay, of history and identity.
Well, like I say, I guess growing up in East LA, East LA was for a long time the Jewish neighborhood of Los Angeles, where they let, was one of the neighborhoods where they allowed Jews to live. There was a big Japanese American population east of the river also. And then obviously other waves of immigrants continually inhabiting that side of the river, because it was kind of, so it was seen as that kind of segregated area where, you know, minorities could go live there, and I guess what the book means to imply is that all of these people bring sort of hidden kingdoms of history, or have left you know, entire homelands behind, and have stories that have crossed distances of thousands of miles to get here, that are living in they're living underneath the legend of the map. They're, you know, like whenever you see some cop movie shot in Los Angeles where all the characters are white, like there's this whole other city really that is being denied, not only sort of the denied in the present, but their whole history, all their histories are, their past is denied, all the potential, all that you know, the consequences of the conquest and this sort of immense reality is denied for the kind of facile commercial present. Even when they're included in the commercial present as I don't know, like Oscar De La Hoya playing golf, or, you know, it's really not. Like, it doesn't really talk about that complexity that is behind that, or refer to it. Did you have a question?
What's the age group of the book is geared to?
What age group? Well, I'm not sure. You know, I'm always hoping that people younger than me are reading me. I think that those of us who are my age and older, that we grew up in a kind of a time of huge desperation and huge expectation of change. That there was this big desperation that the assassination of Martin Luther King, of the civil rights leaders, of presidents, that would accomplish nothing. that the war would go on, that discrimination would go on, that Jim Crow would go on, and that you know, for us people of color, that we would have no more representation, either culturally or politically, than we started with. You know, because it, you know, if they could kill presidents and civil rights leaders and famous people, then the rest of us would be where. You know, so on the other hand, there was this great expectation that things could change for the better. Now, it seems like, on the one hand, there's no great desperation. Like, people do not feel so oppressed. They do not feel like they have to go to Iraq because there's no draft. You don't have to go to Iraq if you don't want to. You can just put the decal, "Support my troops," in your car. Leave it at that. So on the one hand, people don't seem so desperately oppressed. On the other hand, there doesn't seem like there's that expectation that really anything's going to change either. Like, maybe the war will just grind to a halt. And then, like, guys with one arm will be walking around or whatever. So on the other hand, like, the event horizon of hope and fear seems much lower now. And so part of my writing refers to that past, that those decades when we were growing up, because I think that language bears that burden of hope and fear, and that politics of expectation that, you know, if conditions are defied and the politics is expressed, that maybe something could change. Appropriate? Yeah, I mean, it's not for the elementary kids. the length of the sentences themselves kind of shut out maybe half readers wouldn't like the length of the sentences themselves, you know what I mean? No, I think it's more about habits of reading, about people who are kind of willing to take on challenging literature, as opposed to people who are used to a kind of pre-digested literature where it's edited for convenience.
Yeah,